This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowain. What's the true measure of a country's economic health? For decades, the U.S. has used GDP, or gross domestic product, to indicate the country's standard of living. But increasingly, economists, behavioral scientists, even some political leaders are saying that's not good enough, that well-being has to be a factor. Even Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chairman, said we should seek better and more direct measurements of economic well-being. He's even referenced Bhutan's Gross National Happiness Index. So how do you measure happiness and well-being, and what's its relationship to the economy? We have two guests who have joined us. Angus Deaton is a professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University, has been developing a well-being index, and joins us from Princeton University's Broadcast Center. And Angus Deaton, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Arthur Stone. He's been working with Angus Deaton on this well-being index. He's a distinguished professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Stony Brook University. And Arthur Stone, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning.
And I should say that both of our guests are senior scientists at the Gallup Organization. Angus Deaton, let me begin with you. Why do you think there's this growing interest in well-being and the economy?
I think part of it, there's really two parts. One is that there's a growing understanding that GDP is not a very satisfactory measure, that we should target in thinking about economic well-being or even thinking about the economy. It misses a lot. There's a lot of it that's misleading, and we need to work on that to make it better, to include more things, to take it apart in various ways. There's another side of it, is the understanding that we can actually get measures of well-being directly by asking people, and people report how their lives are going. They tell us about their emotional states, and those turn out to have a lot more face validity than economists perhaps used to think. And so there's a real program out here to push forward on both those fronts, I think.
Well, let me go to you, Arthur Stone, and I'm interested in then how do you, and both you and Angus Deaton and others have been working on this notion of well-being, how do you figure out or find out from someone what their sense of their own well-being is?
Well, the basic issue here is that you're asking them questions about their well-being. It's really important to note, though, that there are different kinds of well-being, and the questions you ask about them to get at those different kinds are very, very different. So, real briefly, you can ask people about the meaning in their life. How meaningful do they think what they're doing is? You can ask them to kind of evaluate their life. How happy are they generally with their life? How satisfied are they? And the third way is that you can ask them, how are they feeling? What are their emotions like on a day-to-day basis? And these are all thought of as components of subjective well-being.
Have you found as a psychiatrist or behavioral scientist yourself that people, because those are unusual questions, we don't necessarily always ask those questions of ourselves during the daytime, that the people know how they're feeling and what their emotional well-being is all about, Arthur Stone?
Yeah, that's a good question, because actually that's one of the things that's perplexing in this literature. We think that when you ask people whether they're happy or sad or stressed, for example, or angry, we think that they're pretty good at knowing that.
Right.
However, when you ask people more difficult questions like whether they're seeing meaning in their life or whether they are generally satisfied with their life, those require more reflection. And it may be a more complicated process for how people end up with that answer. So a lot of research that's going on is trying to understand, how are people answering the questions, and are they answering them in ways that we think are meaningful?
Well, I'm curious, as an economist then, Angus Deaton, looking at things like happy, sad, stressed, and angry, how do you see those emotional states?
Well, I think they're very important. We all, in our day-to-day life, use those. I mean, I talk all the time to my kids or to my wife, or she talks to me, and we're checking on how happy you are, how sad you are, how angry you are. That's how we live our lives. Mm-hmm. Economists have not paid a lot of attention to that, but I think they actually should. So if you think of the Great Recession that we went through starting in 2008, It looks, using the Gallup monitoring data, that this caused a lot of stress. It caused a lot of worry in people's lives. And I think policymakers should take that into account. Ben Bernanke is a really good example of someone who plays a very large role in the economy and who's thinking about taking those into account. The trouble is, I don't think you can run the economy entirely based on those numbers, which is why we're much more interested, to some extent, in these life satisfaction numbers. And because life satisfaction sounds more like the sort of thing that we might target as part of economic policy, rather than just taking it into account.
And even in preparing for the show, I was thinking about, you know, happiness and well-being. In my mind, at least, Angus Eaton, those are very different.
Absolutely. Let me give you one example. If you look across the countries of the world, and Gallup now has data on 160 countries over the last 5 or 6 years, if you look at those, there's actually very little relationship between national income and happiness. Mm. People manage to be happy under the most appalling circumstances. And that's because a lot of happiness is to do with interpersonal relationships, to doing things with friends. You can do it just as well in Africa as you can do it in Denmark. Life satisfaction, on the other hand, is this judgment that Arthur was talking about how your overall life is going. The Danes, for instance, are terrific at that, but they're not that happy.
Oh, they're not?
No.
Why aren't the Danes that happy, Angus Eaton?
Well, most of the Danes I know don't look very happy.
Really?
That turns out to be a pretty good indicator that they're not. When you ask Danes, you know, what fraction, were you really happy yesterday? Not all that many. I mean, you know, it's high, maybe 60-70%, mm-hmm. but in many countries it's 85-88% of people who say they were really happy yesterday. And the Danes are pretty low on that. But if you ask them how their life is going, they're the world champions. They always do better than everybody else. And the Danes are very rich. Not just the Danes, but the other Nordic countries do very well, too. So for the life satisfaction is very strongly related to GDP,
right.
Ironically. Whereas happiness is very different.
You want to weigh in on that, Arthur Stone?
I agree with what Angus just said. What it's telling us is that this is a complex situation, this subjective well-being, and that we really need to be careful when we're talking about it. When we use a term like happiness,
right.
Are we talking about this evaluative life satisfaction kind of happiness, or are we talking about the emotional component of happiness? And unfortunately, people in our field sometimes use happiness without telling us which kind they're talking about, and they're different, as Angus just pointed out.
Well, I was looking at this well-being index, and I guess a question or one of the questions is, did you experience a lot of happiness yesterday? Do I have that question right, Arthur Stone?
Yes, that's the question that's used by Gallup. And there are similar types of questions that are being used, for example, by the Office of National Statistics in the UK.
And so when you ask someone, so did you experience a lot of happiness yesterday? Is yesterday an important word as part of that sentence, in that you've had a moment or you've had 24 hours to digest what happened yesterday?
Yes. The reason that we think that it's important, and there's a bunch of evidence supporting this, is that emotions are fleeting, as you well know, mm-hmm. and they're hard to remember. And when you start asking people to remember their emotional happiness over long periods of times, you end up, people can't actually remember that. They can't remember how happy they were on last Thursday, for example. They can probably remember, and there's evidence that they can, remember how happy they were yesterday. So this is a methodological mm-hmm. feature in order not to distort the data by memory problems. And it turns out that when you ask people over long periods, you're actually probably getting closer to these life evaluation satisfaction measures. So it's important to keep the emotional assessment kind of short.
I'm curious, Angus Eaton, how the U.S. then compares to the Danes when it comes to this issue of quote-unquote happiness.
The U.S. does better than the Danes.
They do.
In happiness. And it may have something to do with what you said in your introduction to this show, that Americans are sort of expected to be happy. You know, it's in the Declaration of Independence. Other countries don't really do this. Though, one of the things that's really important to realize is when the Declaration of Independence was drafted, they talked about the pursuit of happiness, yes. Not actually happiness itself. So I think the founders saw the role of government as guaranteeing that people should be able to pursue happiness in their own way, which is a very much an idea of the Enlightenment, rather than the government trying to guarantee people happiness. But Americans, when you ask them that question, report a lot of happiness yesterday.
Well, that's interesting. Let me go back to you, Angus Deaton, if I could. And I know that both of you, and this is, I guess, the hot topic when you talk about GDP and well-being, about the connection between someone's income and happiness and whether, quote-unquote, you know, money can buy you happiness. Is there an answer to that question, Angus Deaton?
I think so. Though, when you ask an academic questions, they always tell you it's complicated.
Yes, I know.
And that's
We're
not really
that.
What you want to hear.
That's
so
okay.
Let me tell you a fairly straightforward thing. I think the lack of money can really bring you misery. And really not having enough to do the sort of things that make you a full participant in society, that allow you to spend time with your friends, to go to a ball game together. You know, I was in Spain last summer when the Euro Cup was on, the soccer tournament, and it was at the height of the financial crisis, and people were really terrified, and there's enormous unemployment in Spain. And when I asked people, were you really happy sometime yesterday, they all said yes. And when I said when, it was always the same thing. It was when the big goal was scored in the game.
Interesting.
The night before, and they were doing it with friends. So that's a really important thing. That's what people, when you're asking people, did you feel a lot of happiness yesterday, that's the sort of thing they're talking about. If you're really, really short of money, you know, you're really scraping, you're pinching, you don't have anything to go out to the ballpark, you don't have anything to go out for a hamburger with your friends, you don't have a chance to have fun or to travel to see your kids, all of those sort of things make people's lives really worse. And I think they really cut back on happiness.
And conversely to you, Arthur Stone, then if having less money makes you less happy, this, you know, seems sort of obvious there, does more money make you more happy?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I think most people would say, well, sure, I'd much rather have more money than less, even at higher levels of income. But I think the data are suggesting, there's a paper by Angus and Danny Kahneman recently that suggests that after a certain level of income, at least in terms of your emotional state, this emotional kind of well-being, it doesn't make much difference. But for the evaluative kind where you're looking at your life and saying, how am I doing, it may make difference. And that kind of makes sense, right? Because when you stop and look, if you have a lot of material possessions, you might say, oh, well, you know, it's really terrific that I have a big house and a fancy car, whatever it happens to be. But does that really impact you on a day-to-day basis in terms of your emotions? It may not, because you're not thinking about your big house and your fancy car. So this really gets to an important distinction between this emotional stuff and the evaluative life satisfaction kind of way of looking at happiness.
And that's Arthur Stone, who joins us along with Angus Deaton. We're talking about happiness, well-being, and economics. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back.
Studio Incaminati School for Contemporary Realist Art in Center City supports WHYY and presents an open house March 16th and 17th. Professional teaching artists provide live model painting demonstrations and individual portfolio reviews. These artists will explain how the innovative curriculum fuses classical traditions and the luminous color of the Impressionists with a modern sensibility. Information on full and part-time drawing, painting, and sculpture programs, scholarships, continuing ed classes, and workshops at studioincaminati.org.
This week on This American Life, we return to Harper High School in Chicago, where we left off last week. A former student was shot just a few blocks from school during the homecoming pep rally. Kids on Harper's football team may be targets for retaliation. The principal has to decide whether to cancel the game and dance, and then there's more violence.
Okay, so I just got word that there was a shooting.
What happens next? This week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
In 1913, thousands marched on Washington, D.C. to argue for the right for women to vote. The suffragists won a constitutional amendment securing that right, but also ushered in the women's movement. 100 years later, we take another look at the suffrage movement, how it transformed the nation, and how it didn't. That's next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we're talking about another way to think about measuring a country's economic health. And our guests are Angus Deaton. He's a professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University, has been developing a well-being index. Also with us is Arthur Stone, who's been working on this well-being index. He's a distinguished professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Stony Brook University. Both of our guests are senior scientists at the Gallup organization, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Angus Deaton, even going back to some of this research that you have been doing, it seems like $75,000 is a kind of a cutoff number that we should think about.
That's what the data say.
And what does the data mean? Go ahead.
Well, it does mean that above that, it doesn't seem to matter. And we interpret that to mean that anyone who's got that just doesn't really have any worries about the sort of things that guarantee your emotional well-being. The below that, a little bit below that, presumably doesn't do much harm. But if you're deeply below that, you know, you're just so hurting from not having enough money that you can't do the things that make life worth living. On the other hand, above the $75,000, this, as Arthur said, this sense of how your life is going seems to go on increasing. And that may simply be because being better educated, having a very high salary, being successful in life rather than being happy, think of this as sort of achievement. Then the more money you have, the further up you are in the social scale, the better educated you are. Those things seem to increase your life satisfaction and keep on going with higher incomes. People who are more educated are no happier than people who are less educated, but people who are more educated have much higher life satisfaction than people who are less educated.
That's interesting.
Which is just a way of telling you they're really very different things.
So if we were to include some of what we've been talking about in our GDP, would we have, do you think, Arthur, Angus Deaton, would we have different policies?
I think we might. Let me give you an example. One thing we haven't really talked about is how bad GDP is in lots of ways.
Enough.
Because there's a lot of stuff. I mean, I was listening to our governor, Governor Christie, yesterday, talking about how one of the reasons that GDP is going to go up in New Jersey over the next year is because of Hurricane Sandy. Right? Now, if you think about that, we have a huge, devastating hurricane that leaves many houses completely destroyed, has destroyed whole communities on the shore of New Jersey, and that increases GDP. What are we talking about here? Because what we're doing is, the governor is completely right, that what happens is it stimulates the construction activity to repair, but GDP doesn't count the destruction itself. So that you might actually pick up if you were looking at people's life satisfaction and so on. Let me give you another example.
Sure.
GDP is completely insensitive to who gets it. So, you know, GDP could go up by 10%, and it all goes to the top 1%, for instance. If you look at economic growth in the United States, it's much higher than in France. But if you look at economic growth in the bottom 99%, it's actually lower in the United States than in France. So the GDP numbers just don't tell us who's getting it at all. Life satisfaction is much more sensitive to that. So if you look at what's happening to life satisfaction over time, it really doesn't respond nearly as well as not as much as GDP has, because so much of the growth has gone to the top. In fact, there's been very little increase in American life satisfaction over the last 25 years, in spite of the GDP growth. And that's not because life satisfaction is a lousy indicator. It's because GDP is a lousy indicator.
That's very interesting.
So, you know, happiness may not be perfect measure, but you have to think of it in the context of how bad GDP is.
Go ahead, Arthur Stone. Sounds like you want to say something.
Let me throw in one other thing that Angus mentioning Hurricane Sandy brings to mind, and I think it's an important point, and that is that this whole discussion of subjective well-being or well-being in general, it has the opposite side, too, and that is that many of the measures, especially in the emotional area that we've been studying, have to do with negative emotions, anger, stress, worry. And these are really the flip side. So we're also looking at misery. And I think that's important because, especially when we start talking about whether governments should be looking at these measures or not, some people are critical and they say, well, is it really government's job to increase people's happiness in general? And you can debate that. But I don't think there's a whole lot of debate about whether government should be trying to alleviate misery. And that's an important point here. We label this well-being, but it's actually looking at the flip side as well.
Let me ask you, Arthur Sonder, because I know you have done some work tracking, I guess, age and well-being, looking at this, the sense of well-being over time as you look at populations. And what have you found as people age, the kind of ebb and flow, I guess, of well-being?
Yeah, happy to talk about that. This is from the Gallup data, so it's many hundreds of thousands of people. And we have to really make the distinction between the life satisfaction kind of well-being and the emotional, because they're very different in these analyses. A pattern that we found in this somewhat recent publication is that there's kind of a U-shape. Imagine age going from 18 on the left-hand side of a graph to 80 on the right-hand side, and well-being on the y-axis. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a U-shape, so that well-being in terms of evaluative well-being, life satisfaction, is high in the 20s, drops down to the lowest point around 50, and then increases up through the 70s. That's for life evaluation. Mm-hmm. Now, if we flip to the emotions, we see a very different pattern for the negative emotions. Let me give you one example. For how stressed were you feeling yesterday, we see that the level of stress is very high, say from age 18 through about 45 or 50, then there's a precipitous decline all the way down through age 70. And that's a very different pattern. And what it suggests, and worry looks very similar to that, and what it suggests is that as people age, they are feeling less of these negative emotions and more life evaluation, higher levels of satisfaction with their lives.
It seems like it's also saying that that middle period when many people have children, some get married or in relationships, that that's a difficult time or a stressful time.
We don't know exactly what that is, but we're currently investigating this whole notion about children, and perhaps it's a little too soon to say what we think. Angus, you don't want to say anything about
that,
do you?
Yeah, do you want to say something, Angus?
Well, there's a lot of things going on in middle age. I mean, people are usually working very hard, too. So if you look at the number of hours people work, the peak is in middle age. Right. You have kids at home. There's a lot of stress associated. They're often teenage kids. They may be or may not be bringing you a lot of joy, but they're sure bringing you a lot of stress and worry. And, I mean, in some sense, I like this perspective that Arthur's put, that we should be focusing more on these negative emotions. You know, it's not a happiness. It's almost like a science of misery.
Oh, dear.
And, you know, while economists have been very resistant to happiness, we just can't resist misery. I mean, we are the dismal science, after all.
Is that true? Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Angus Deaton, professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University. Also with us, Arthur Stone. He's a distinguished professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Stony Brook University. Both of them have been working on developing a well-being index, and they're both senior scientists at the Gallup organization. I do want to get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Dorsey from Newcastle to join us. And Dorsey, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I'm calling because it seems to me that the most important thing is really contentment, which underlies happiness, which it seems to me is more transitory. So you're very happy. I mean, happy just seems a more temporary emotion. Mm. Oh, you're happy if you get a lovely present from someone or someone. I mean, it may go on for some time, but what you really need is contentment as the basis.
Well, that's interesting, Dorsey. And if I could toss that first to you, I guess, Angus Deaton, contentment.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that contentment may be closer to life satisfaction than it is to happiness. And it's certainly true that this happiness is a temporary emotion that many people wouldn't pay a lot of attention to. I mean, I grew up in a Calvinist village in Scotland, and, you know, in my Calvinist village, being happy was regarded as a pretty serious mental weakness.
Really?
Whereas, you know, contentment or life satisfaction, there was a lot of smugness and life satisfaction, right? So that would have been all right. But to be serious, I do think this contentment is a longer-term notion. It's not an adjective or a noun that we've used very much in our research, and perhaps we should spend more time on it.
Do you think growing up in this Calvinist town got you interested in this issue of well-being and happiness?
Yeah, I think so. Because it makes you wonder about the environment being very important. Reporting styles are very important, too. So, you know, where I grew up in Scotland, and that's true, you know, in much of Britain, if you say to someone, you know, how's life? How are you doing? About the strongest you'd ever get is mustn't grumble, right? Which is not a very positive endorsement. And it seems like in Latin America, people will say fantastico or something. And you get very high ratings in Latin America. So some of that may be reporting styles.
Well, and also, Arthur Stone, it also taps into cultural differences. You know, that we are talking about something that is, I think, subjective, even if we're talking about well-being.
Absolutely. And what Angus just pointed out is actually one of the challenges that researchers in the well-being area are facing. Actually, not just the well-being area. It's the self-reported health area as well, and that is that when you hear country comparisons, that such and such country has better health than another country, and it's based on these people making ratings of their health, or the same thing for well-being, it's possible that it's how people are reporting, how they're using words, how they interpret the words that we're giving them, that are creating some of these country differences. So there's a lot of effort going into trying to figure out ways around that to ensure that the comparisons are really, you know, apples to apples and not apples to oranges in different countries.
And I wonder whether people even think relatively, and by that I mean, you know, let's say I make $50,000 a year and I have a friend that makes $150,000 a year, and Arthur Stone, you know, I might compare my level of satisfaction to what I see my friend enjoying, and that might impact how I felt about my life.
Indeed, this is something that behavioral scientists and economists have been looking at, and as a matter of fact, Angus and I have recently looked at this in one forum. Angus, do you want to mention that?
Yeah, go ahead, Angus.
Yeah, I could talk a little bit about that. The economists are really very interested in this because, you know, if you get really happy, or let's put it another way, if you get really unhappy because your neighbor does really well, then the policy implication of that is we should tax your neighbor because they're hurting you. We should discourage your neighbor from working because then we stop them inflicting pain on you. A lot of work in this field argues that that effect is quite strong and quite real, but it's very controversial. The work that Arthur was talking about that we've done together quite recently tends that we just don't find much evidence of that effect at all, which for us is a good thing. I mean, I don't think it's a great thing taxing people just because they do well because their neighbors are jealous of them, but I don't find very much effect of that.
Well, that's interesting. Let me see what Bill from the Northeast has to say. And Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I enjoy the program. Do
Thank you.
Find if a person looks at themselves as being an optimist, that they're generally happy no matter what their financial strata? And then my question, a comment, is that when people come from other countries to America, do you find that they're happier, too, because they have opportunities that they didn't have where they came from?
Bill, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Arthur Stone, can I toss that first to you?
Well, by definition, optimists are people who report being happy in all kinds of situations. So I think the caller is right in that optimists tend to have higher levels of well-being, although I'm not sure that the concept of optimism and its inverse, pessimism, have been studied very much in relation to the different kinds of well-being. Can't think of a study offhand. In terms of folks coming from one country to another and what that does to their well-being and why, again, I'm drawing a blank on that. Perhaps, Angus, do you know of anything on that?
Yeah, I mean, Gallup has actually done some work on that, and the truth is
that
the migrants actually are better than the people that are left behind. Part of the problem with that, of course, is the migrants are not the same as the people who are left behind.
They're the ones that left.
They're the ones that left, and, you know, they may be the more successful, the happier people to start. So I don't think that's really been sorted out. I agree with Arthur about optimism, but it's clear that people have different dispositions, and there are just sunny, happy people who seem to be that way, more or less whatever happens to them, and other people who are pretty damn miserable all the time.
And I think we all know both of those people, hopefully. Bill, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Arthur, if I can go back to you, and again, just reading some of the research that you've done, and I hope I'm summarizing this correctly, but we tend to enjoy our vacations more in hindsight than when we're actually on vacation. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's actually, it's not my work, but it's out there, and that's it exactly. This has to do with how do people remember things? And the study that you're talking about is one that looked at how will you be thinking about your vacation, how much do you think you will enjoy it before it happens, then monitoring people through the vacation, how they actually felt, and then looking at them in hindsight. And I think you did summarize that correctly. And this has to do with a whole set of psychological processes that have to do with how people think about the past and how do people think about the future. So, for example, a really good notion here is something called the focusing illusion, which has to do with when you're looking forward, say, thinking about making a move to a different state or something along those lines, how do you make that judgment? What do you focus on in order to make the judgment? And it turns out we're not particularly good at that, which is quite distressing when you think about it.
Indeed, and as an economist, is that worrisome to you, Angus Deaton, that we don't do this very well?
Yes, it is worrying. But, you know, economists have traditionally taken the view that people never make mistakes, they know what is good for them, and they act in their best interests all the time. And, you know, that's not a really very good assumption either, because it's missing a lot of what goes on in real life. And I think economists need to take that into account. So, I mean, this is sort of a good point for an interplay between me and Arthur, because the psychologists have come up with all these strange findings which make economists extremely uncomfortable. And one way that economists deal with them is just to ignore them. But, you know, that's becoming increasingly infeasible. And I think economists have to do a lot of work on their own to figure out how to build those findings into the way we think about well-being and we think about policy. That task is sort of ahead. I think it's really helpful that we're beginning to take these things seriously. But, you know, we're not done yet, and we don't really know. And there were good reasons for what we did before. We were maybe a little self-satisfied, but, you know, we did a pretty good job.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Again, that's Angus Deaton, Professor of Economics and International Affairs at Princeton University. Also with us, Arthur Stone, Distinguished Professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Stony Brook University. We're talking about well-being and happiness and economies and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Fleischer Art Memorial proudly supports WHYY and has a 115-year tradition of providing art classes for thousands of children and adults throughout the Delaware Valley. There are workshops in drawing, painting, sculpting, and more taught by Fleischer's noted faculty. The Fleischer Art Memorial spring term begins April 6th and offers more than 60 art workshops. Registration and more information is available online at fleischer.org.
As speculation swirls about why Pope Benedict XVI chose to resign, the Church is dealing with the child sex abuse scandal, a money laundering probe involving the Vatican Bank, and reports of financial and sexual misconduct among Church officials. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Vatican correspondent John Favis. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's Daytime News Magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up, plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now. Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. There seems to be growing interest among some economists, those in the mental health field, to expand the definition of GDP to include people's thoughts about the quality of their lives. One of the early critics of GDP was Robert Kennedy. I want to play a clip from a speech that he gave back in 1968 on March 18th, where he criticized the GDP. And let's hear the very end of what he said that day.
Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are Americans.
Angus Deaton, I've heard that many, many times, and every time I'm practically moved to tears when I hear Robert Kennedy talk that way.
It's just terrific.
It is terrific.
Why don't we have speeches like that anymore? I think that's the banner under which we're all marching on this. And, of course, it's impossible to think about doing everything he wanted to do.
Right.
But, you know, a lot of people around the world, in the U.S., the OECD is extremely interested in this. The statisticians at OECD are sort of spearheading this effort in many ways, is to try and, A, make GDP better so that some of the things that RFK talked about are better captured, and also to go the other way, which is to look directly at people's well-being and see if we can pick up some of those things that make life worth living and that are really not captured in our day-to-day statistics. I don't think we want to replace GDP,
right,
or that we want to get some combined index that's half happiness and half GDP. But, you know, we need to broaden our horizons. This is a world nowadays full of data. You know, we really ought to be able to focus on more than one number.
You agree with that, Arthur Stone?
Sure. When you listen to Kennedy's speech, you see that even our subjective well-being measures are just a very small part of what this broad swath of things that he's talking about, and certainly no one's talking about replacing GDP, but we're talking about expanding it, as Angus says, and this is one effort to do that. There probably will be other kinds of efforts, other ways of trying to determine how well people are doing, whether policies are effective, but this is just one effort, and it's not going to be the only effort.
Let me get some callers back in on the conversation. Looks like we have Susanna from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. And Susanna, go ahead.
Hi.
You're on the air. Hi.
I lived in Guatemala for almost a decade, and I would walk a certain route almost every day, and I got to see the onion farmers, and they're all Mayans, still dressed in their typical traje, and there were three, maybe even four generations, each having their own little tasks to do. I couldn't speak with them because I didn't speak their language, but it was clear, it was really obvious that they were very, at least content and perhaps even happy in what they were doing. And they were living on poverty level, for certain. I may have gotten a different story if I had asked them questions, but visually these people were very, very happy in what they were doing. And all I kept on thinking was they were doing the best with what they have. And I don't know if you've used that marker on any level when you are interviewing people and whether you've interviewed people who are like the indigenous.
Well, it's a great question. Susanna, can I start with you, Angus Deaton?
Yeah, I think that's a real insight, and I think it's really true. And I don't think we've interviewed people exactly like that, but when the Gallup people have interviewed people all over Africa, places like Afghanistan, Cambodia, Iraq, places where we would think that life was really, really hard. And I think people do find a lot of contentment, a lot of happiness in their day-to-day lives. And if you could have talked to those people, you would find out that that was really true. Mm. But here's a big issue, and this is an issue that the economist and philosopher Amartya Sen has talked about a lot. Do we really want to stop there? So let's find that those man onion farmers were really very, very happy in the sense there's a lot of joy in their lives. They have good family relationships. But I don't know what their infant mortality rate is, for instance. And I bet it's a lot worse than in the United States. So some of those people, and let's go away from the Mayans, but if we go to Africa and so on, some of these people are seeing 10% of all their children die in the first year of life. These people really are living on something like $1 or $1.25 a day. They live in systems where there's very little justice. They live in states that have no state capacity. They live with police forces that harass them on a day-to-day basis. That's the objective facts of their lives. And I don't think we can trump that just because somehow they managed to find some happiness in their day-to-day life. You can't simply ignore the deprivations, these objective deprivations, just because people are sometimes happy. And that's a big debate in the literature because utilitarian philosophers, for instance, argue that happiness is everything.
Sure.
And if these people are happy, their destitution really doesn't matter. I don't believe that. And I don't think it entitles us to ignore destitution around the world just because people find some modicum of happiness in their lives.
Arthur Storm, be curious what you have to say.
Yeah, like much of what Angus says, I'm in agreement with it. And I think it's just true that people make the best out of whatever situation they're in, sometimes even forgetting in some sense what situation they're in. Humans are very adaptable. And that's why, again, subjective well-being should just be part of a set of tools that are used to evaluate well-being. And I think places like the World Health Organization do use multiple tools. When they talk about well-being, they're simply not talking about subjective well-being, what you get from people's mouths. They're talking about some of the objective characteristics of the environment that people are living in, as Angus just said, and they can't be ignored. People will try to thrive. They will try to derive happiness from whatever environment they're in, including prisons, for example. But we can't ignore the objective right. circumstances as well.
But I'm curious, Arthur, whether having or being part of an extended family or being part of a kind of cohesive community, does that help mitigate some of the difficulties in life? Does that help in the happiness index or the well-being index?
Sure. We're switching now to the topic of what kind of things predict well-being.
Right.
And certainly interpersonal relationships are some of the most salient, most strongest predictors of well-being. Being married, having friends and family are incredibly important predictors. And we've known that in psychology and health psychology for many, many years. There are even biological indicators suggesting that having a good social network is very, very important.
I wonder, too, and this may be going out a bit on a limb, Angus, but would it be fair to say that if someone is a happy employee, that they're a better employee? I'm trying to sort of extrapolate from these large populations to an individual, whether it works that way.
I think it does. And, you know, Gallup spends a lot of its time monitoring how employees are
right.
and how they feel about their jobs. And it's certainly true that having very unhappy and very disengaged employees, the sort of employees who come to work determined to sabotage the business every day, is a really, really bad idea. And we've all met a few of those, too.
Indeed, we have. Let me get Jim from Newtown, Pennsylvania. Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I was wondering about the influence of advertising on measures of life satisfaction. It seems to me that advertisers try to make everybody feel not satisfied, so they'll buy the product. You know, you need more hair, so buy our product. You're not a good parent unless you feed your kids our product. So theoretically, if everyone was satisfied, no one would buy anything, and the economy would suffer.
It's a great.
Could you comment on that?
And I hope so. And Jim, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Angus Deaton, what do you think?
I sympathize with the view, and I feel very much the same way. I'm not sure I know of any objective evidence. I could say one thing, though. One thing that we've thought about is when we're assessing poverty in the United States, we just ask people whether they're poor instead of doing, you know, the complicated things that the Census Bureau does now when it assesses poverty. And I think that actually would be not a bad way of going. The thing that you worry about is advertising, not so much by manufacturers, but by political interest groups who want to manipulate the poverty line. So you can imagine, you know, an association for the elderly saying, all old people, when you're asked on the phone how you're doing, say you're really, really miserable. And that'll increase the poverty rate and get more attention for us. So we worried about that a little bit. So I don't know any empirical evidence, though.
Do you, Arthur, just picking up on our caller's question, but do you think advertising creates a kind of discontent?
I think so. I'm not real familiar with the evidence, but I do know that in business schools and schools of marketing, the kind of things that we're talking about, the kind of influences of emotions and well-being, are being considered as part of the curriculum now because these are factors that motivate people to buy stuff. So although I'm not familiar with the literature very, very well, I think that the caller is probably quite correct.
Jim, thanks for the call. Let's see what Don from Collingswood has to say. And Don, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling to ask your guests if they've considered sex and sexuality as part of their measure of wellness, and if they have, what they've found, and if they haven't, why they haven't.
And Don, what do you mean by sex and sexuality?
Well, we know that they talk about interpersonal relationships being an important part, and they talk of well-being, and they talk about how important that is, and right. And a key aspect of that is just this sense of being satisfied and feeling good about one's own sexuality, whether it's their gender or their experience of their sexual orientation, but also in their interpersonal relationships and the quality of their sexual expression.
Oh, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Arthur Stone, have you looked at that?
Well, yes, we have actually. Well, part of it anyway. Some ways of measuring the emotions, the emotional part of well-being, has to do with having people tell us about the events of their day. And as a matter of fact, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has a every two-year survey that does exactly that, sort of deconstructs a day into its components. We know from our work that intimate relations are one of the most satisfying parts of the day when people report it. And that goes into the calculation of how was their emotion for the entire day. So I suppose what I'm saying isn't very surprising. I think most people would say that intimate relations, you know, should be up there pretty high.
So
we do use it in that way. But in terms of the more general point that the gentleman was making having to do with satisfaction with one's sexual orientation, that I'm not so sure about. I don't know of any evidence of that.
Don, thanks for the call. Let's see if we can squeeze David from Havertown on Radio Times. And David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. This calls for Angus Deaton.
Yes.
Being that Ben Bernanke is also from Princeton, I would assume you two know each other, and was wondering what kind of information or ideas to try to put into his head as far as how he should form the Fed policy.
David, thanks for the call. Have you gotten inside the Fed Secretary's head, Angus Deaton?
I don't think so. He's a good friend. He was a terrific chairman of my department. He learned to solve problems by spending money on them when he was chairman at Princeton, and he's taken that skill to the Fed.
It's kind of his job,
But it's interesting because I had no idea he was interested in these topics until he made a speech talking about it and advocating that we look at these issues. So I think there's a broad current going on here, which several have been swept up in, and I don't think I got inside Ben's head or that anyone else did either. Ben's a pretty independent guy, and one of the things his staff will tell you is just what an incredible amount of stuff he reads.
Oh, that's interesting. Angustine, is there something we could learn from Bhutan, do you think?
Yeah, I'm not so sure.
No?
I think they have found a very good niche. They're riding this wave, too. I'm not sure that the way they do things is very useful. And I'm a bit suspicious of the political motives that caused them to lead the way on this. But they've certainly got a lot of mileage out of it and a lot of international attention.
And we're almost out of time here. I know you have advised the French government on a happiness survey. How are the French doing?
Well, President Sarkozy, when he was president of France, set up a commission to look at these issues. And I think, you know, one could be forgiven for suspecting that part of the aim was to show that France is actually doing a lot better than the United States in spite of the GDP statistics. And there's a lot of basis for that. So, you know, they take a lot more leisure than we do, and we don't count that in GDP. They have much better health than we do, and that's not counted either. So there's a case for looking at these things.
And well, they enjoy their eating more, too.
And we enjoy their food as well. Well, thank you so much, Angus Deaton and Arthur Stone, for joining us today on Radio Time. It's been a very interesting conversation.
Thanks very much for having me on.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Us as well. Angus Deaton, Professor of Economics and International Affairs at Princeton University. Arthur Stone, Distinguished Professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Stony Brook University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Find out about Facebook, Twitter, archives, podcasts, Sirius Satellite Radio, and much, much more. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Heather Bromfield is our intern today, and the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.